This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everybody. Welcome in the U.S. and around the world. This is Baseball Outside the Box, the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge of status quo. We're currently live on Facebook and Zoom, and the audio will be placed on the podcast, Baseball Outside the Box. You can also check it out on video on YouTube after the show at Peter Caliendo. We got a lot of great guests there, along with the fantastic guests today. We've had Clint Hurdle, Tony La Russa, Glenn Fysick, Ken Revisa. We've had a lot of people. And speaking about great minds, he is the greatest example of learning. I love this guy. I've seen him so many places. He's been on Zoom, always listening. And I got to tell you a quick story real fast. About 15 years ago, I had a set of DVDs, five of them. And out of the blue, I knew who he was. He asked me if I'd send him the set. One of them was pitching. He wanted to take a look at it. Well, I'll be honest with you. I was too scared to send it to him because this guy's too good. I was worried about that. He'd say, this thing's terrible. I'll send it back to you. But what a fantastic person. Y'all know him, Brett Strom, Houston Astros pitching coach. And by the way, he was the second guy to have Tommy John surgery. Let's welcome a fantastic individual, just a brilliant man, Brent Strom. Brent, how you doing, buddy?
Good, Pete. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, are you kidding? Thank you. And thank you to all our guests online and on Zoom and everywhere. We're also on Twitter. Thank you to all of you. Let's get rocking and rolling right away because, Brent, probably the number one question comes up on every show all the time, and that is, you've got your big league pitchers out there. They're doing their work somewhere at home or on some complex that they have and maybe in their backyard. What are some of the questions they ask you that maybe they need to, they ask about working out and to prepare themselves, especially to make sure that they're ready so they don't get hurt?
Well, Pete, it's a difficult time for everybody concerned right now. We stayed in touch with all our pitchers at the major league level. And what we've done in combination with our trainers and strength and conditioning people is set up as many different programs as we can for each guy. For example, Lance McCullers, who missed all of last year, is much further along than many others. It's almost as though he's had a season already. He's throwing bullpens. He's throwing the scouting reports. And then we've had others that more of the veteran guys that have taken a little more of a slow walk, but we're staying in touch with them and making them aware of whatever information we have. The one thing we didn't want to do was completely shut down and try and ramp up. I believe you had a podcast a couple weeks ago with Ron Wolford and Randy Sullivan talking about ramping people up. And that's one thing that we're trying to do on a conservative basis so that when the bell rings, these guys will be ready.
Fantastic. I know that, we wanted to discuss, something folks were trying to do here is everybody really, we've had a lot of shows on biomechanics and the movements and pitching and all that. We want to try to get to some other areas. One of them is, Brent, let's jump on it right away. And that's type of pitches, and also the usage, how to use certain pitches. I know you wanted to get into that.
Well, one of the things that I learned a long time ago is that everybody's unique. And really, you're defined as a pitcher by what the ball does as it crosses home plate. And in my time with the Dodgers, for example, I had the benefit of working with my favorite pitcher of all time, Sandy Koufax. And we talked about, the curveball. And this benefited me this past year with Garrett Cole in terms of the way Sandy taught me, the way he threw his curveball, helped me with Cole in teaching the slider and helping him with his slider. And, of course, the benefits, you saw what the benefits were. And so things like grips, in fact, holding the four-seam fastball across seams where your thumb is located with the curveball, understanding that the two most important fingers for me were the middle finger and the ring finger, and that the thumb is really immaterial. Things like that were really important. Then let's take a split finger, for example. In studying Mike Scott, the former reliever, former starter, great starter for the Astros, we started to realize what Mike did with his split finger, whatever grip he had. One of the things he used to do when he'd get two strikes with the split finger was to utilize a secret that Phil Niekro and a lot of the knuckleball pitchers did, was to go down, get some dirt between the fingers so that the ball was a little more slippery. And so then he would throw what I would affectionately call a bastard split. And anybody who wants to see pitches defy gravity, go do a YouTube of Mike Scott. So a lot of these different things with grips, and we now have the advantage of the Eggertronic and all the equipment that allows us to see what the ball is actually doing as it leaves a pitcher's hand. For example, and I won't get long-winded, but Justin Verlander, for example, great slider. When he struggles with his slider, there's times when he pronates a little bit prematurely, and it cuts down the spin. So then we have drills and things like that, which will help him get it back online. So even the best of pitchers at times run into grip problems, release problems, and that's where the technology today really helps.
Does the technology help? You know, and I know most of us understand that, you know, everybody, you know, you got to practice, you know, sometimes different grips. This grip might work for one pitcher, another one might not. Technology show hand strength, hand size. How much of a difference that make?
Well, hand size, you know, obviously with the split finger, it helps. But I've seen people with small hands have great breaking balls. One that comes to mind is Fernando Valenzuela, who had very small hands that could really spin the ball. Then you have a guy like Zach Britton, who has extremely small hands, has a great sinker. So a lot of times it's just how the ball comes out of their hand, at what angle, and creating the ultimate spin that you're looking for. What technology does for us now is it takes a lot of the guesswork out, so that when a pitcher throws a pitch and we deem it as a good pitch, we can go and look at the spin rate, we can look at the spin axis, we can look at things immediately, and then make an adjustment and through trial and error come up with the correct type of spin that we're looking for.
You know, on today's show, we have people in the U.S. and around the world. We're talking about, you know, Korea, Italy, Czech Republic, you name it. They're from Canada. We've also got certain levels. We've got a lot of big league guys on here. We got development guys. We're going to get into a little bit of the development area. Question on the changeup. I guess my question would be, you know, I know there's different grips for the changeup, and especially when the kids are younger, you know, it's nice to have a changeup, possibly three fingers. But a lot of times you'll see guys turn over their hand on the changeup because it's possibly a natural motion. Is that okay to do? And I mean, it seems to reduce velocity a lot of times.
Yeah, I'm glad you, Pete, I'm glad you asked this question about the changeup. What happens with the changeup is that it's a misunderstood pitch. It's the one thing that TrackMan and a lot of the technology doesn't really recognize. Arm speed is the most important thing. There's three parts of the changeup. There's location, ball movement, and arm speed. For me, arm speed is the number one thing. There are some people like Marco Estrada, formerly of the Blue Jays, had a tremendous changeup with straight backspin. The late Johnny Padres, former Dodger, had a great changeup with the backspin. And then there's others that have create the side spin, and you see the 3 o'clock spin from a right-handed pitcher. So any way that you can kill speed and still maintain arm speed becomes a great pitch. Maddox did a great job of it. There was just a YouTube video this morning that I watched of Dan Straley, former pitcher of mine, who threw one against Korea that was really fabulous. So it's a great pitch. I would strongly urge parents and young coaches coaches dealing with their youth to teach this pitch immediately if they can.
You know, if you just joined, don't forget you could type your question in the chat section. I know we got a lot of brilliant people on the show. If you got any questions, no questions, we're going to try to get them all, but none of them are bad questions. I think they're all great questions we get. Question on this one, type of pitches that could possibly too much stress on your arm and that you would encourage maybe younger players not to throw, and then, you know, pitches as you get older also.
Well, you know, I get asked this question a lot, Pete, and I make a joke about it. If I ever had had a young boy, I teach him to throw a curveball about a week after he got out of the womb, to be honest with you. I don't think that any one pitch is injurious to the arm. I think that done incorrectly, it is. And so that's why the curveball requires a little bit of care sometimes, but taught correctly. And I think one of the things coaches should recognize is if they can get information on how to teach the curveball, for example, correctly, the younger the person starts or under control and you monitor the workload, they start to get the feel for this. If we realize, Pete, that we really learn at a very rapid rate between the ages of 6 and 14. I think it's important and imperative that that the coaches start to show the correct way, because if they don't show it to them, then the young boy who's 12 years old is going to go play in a little league tournament, and he's going to see his opposition dropping down, manipulating the curveball, spinning the curveball, and having great success, and he'll want to mimic that particular pitch. So I think it's important for the coaches to recognize, and there's plenty of information out there, how to throw a proper curveball, how to throw a proper changeup, the fastballs. I mean, people hurt their arms not because of the pitch, but because of poor movement patterns.
One more, and then we're going to take a question from Mark Fuller, I believe. We got several questions. One is, you know, when you're talking about not the mechanical aspect, but when we're talking about selecting pitches, and, you know, young kids like to throw, obviously, the curveball, and all of a sudden you see them throw some sliders also. I mean, something, anything that moves, they like to throw. Does any of that affect their ability to get the right release point, the right movement patterns, you guys call them? So can it, and if I'm throwing the wrong pitch early on, could that affect that?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of guys will, when they try and induce movement, let's say we're trying to move, have a ball run in on a right-handed hitter and he's a right-handed pitcher, you see the arm drop, because it's a very natural, easy way to create that movement that they're trying to create. You know, it's funny, but the way technology is shown right now, the straight fastball is a very, very good pitch. Very, very good pitch. With fastball with hop up in the zone, we're starting to see a lot of people have success with that, where it used to be horizontal movement, side-to-side movement became the important thing. Now you're seeing a vertical type of approach, which just the straight fastball with backspin can be very effective. So I think you need to, what I try and tell my pitchers is, have a baseline, know where your forcing fastball is right down the middle of the plate, and then work off of that particular pitch with your other pitches. It's kind of like hitting a golf club, with a golf club hitting a golf ball. You hit your 5-iron the same way you hit your 7-iron. You don't take a different swing. It's just the angles and the positions of the hand on the baseball that impart spin on the baseball that is going to be your thing. And you had Perry Husbands on board on your show a while back. And Perry's one of my go-to guys, which I'll discuss later. And we talk about tunneling pitches, making pitches come out of the hand looking exactly the same. In the World Series of 2019, I heard a lot of our hitters coming back. At Strasburg, for example, great curveball, comes out of the same slot as his fastball and gave us fits. There was no pop to his curveball. It didn't elevate out of his hand. So if you can develop these tunnels and maintain your forcing fastball right down the middle and know where that pitch is, then I think it's easy to control the other pitches.
Which pitches are you trying to work together with when you're talking about tunneling? Are there certain pitches you work together? Might as well get in, because we went from grip, well, right into tunneling.
Well, you know, for example, one of Perry's number one things is the up and in fastball, the right-handed hitters, followed by a curveball. They both come out of the same tunnel. So you have two pitches. One is picking up speed up and in. The other is going away. And that's just a simple tunnel. Another great tunnel, fastball right down the middle of the plate. Fastball right down the middle of the plate, followed by a changeup right down the middle of the plate. I'm talking dead center, Pete. And too many times we get concerned about hitting corners and understanding that. When you realize that major league pitchers miss their target by an average of 16 inches per pitch, we're not superhuman at the major league level. And so when you're asking young people to hit the down and away corner time after time, you're asking for trouble. So give them part of the plate to aim for. Give them a margin for error so a pitch could run inside, run outside, whatever. And then, you know, back to grips, whatever your spin is, try and match it up with different pitches so that you're sequencing these pitches as best as possible.
You know, and Roger Savoldelli, I should be able to pronounce that, good Italian name. Yes, he talks about, I can't mess up those names, I'm in trouble. He asked about the spin rate versus the velocity, the difference between the two, and then the certain, you know, when you're like Cole, you know, he all of a sudden was pitching up high. How do you know what velocity and what spin rate do you pitch at high at a certain point? Where do you know what the numbers are?
Well, Roger Savoldelli is my good buddy from Switzerland. I've done clinics with him. And, oh, Roger, good to talk to you. Roger, Roger's benefit, here he is in Switzerland. He's bought a Rapsodo machine. He does all the different things that we're trying to do here, and he's trying to do the best he can for Swiss baseball. As far as spin rate's concerned, spin rates sometimes can be overrated. You know, Adam Wainwright, Kershaw, these kind of people, these great pitchers, their spin rate is actually below major league average, but their ability to throw it over the plate, to create pressure to each hitter, with the hitter realizing that they have command of the pitch, trumps the spin rate, okay? Now, as far as spin rate for fastballs up in the zone, some pitchers develop a tremendous spin rate. They can make the ball spin quicker than others, but it's not a panacea for understanding that when hitters are able to eliminate pitches because you never throw it for a strike, you never put pressure on them, then they become much better. So I would err on the side of command of each pitch, understanding how to use each pitch, rather than trying to chase that velocity model or that spin rate model that everybody thinks is the be all and end all.
Well said. Since we have this time, quickly, I just want to thank Brent for traveling around the world for ISG Baseball. President Tom O'Connell is on, also listening to the show. You know, one of the things that George Martin asked here, and I think it relates to the article you had sent me, that the Astros are very good, obviously, at one, drafting players, two, select making trades, and that all takes skill, obviously, and you have to have science behind it, understand certain guys, and then you get them and you got to develop them, and that takes a whole other ball game also, and obviously changing a player that maybe comes from another ball club. So the question here is basically, what things you look for when assessing how to get the best out of a pitcher who may have struggled in his former club?
Well, you know, a lot of times I get a lot of credit for this, and I have to defer to our minor league people and also to our analysts with the Astros. We were cutting edge. Some might call it bleeding edge in terms of going after some low-hanging fruit, so to speak, and identifying characteristics that a pitcher may have. For example, Colin McHugh, who had a nice run with us, is now with the Red Sox. Had struggled early in his career, sinker slider type pitcher, was moving the ball horizontally. Our analyst identified that he could really spin a curveball very well and had great command of the pitch. And so we took that curveball that he has, and rather than trying to run sinkers off that curveball, we started to talk to him about four-seam fastballs up in the zone. So we took a horizontal movement pattern that he had had, and all we did was flip the strike zone on its head and started to work top of the zone with heaters and breaking balls down below. And he was a 19-game winner one year for us and was a main contributor to our World Series championship season. And so those are the kind of things that our analysts and our front office people are so adept at. And so much of the credit goes to them and to our minor league people that are following suit with what we're doing at the major league level.
Whether it's Cole or anybody else, or any players, we don't have to get into specifics of an individual, but, you know, the difficulty of getting guys to change something, especially if they've been successful at other clubs, but yet you still see something. You need the science, and then what else is involved in that?
Well, there's a selling job. We give them the objective facts, okay? Garrett Cole, for example, was a very good pitcher with the Pittsburgh Pirates. You're not a number one draft choice and pitch as well as he did, pitch playoff games for the Pirates. All we did when we brought him in is we noticed a tendency, you know, he was throwing sinkers to right-handed hitters. A lot of those pitches would end up down and in to right-handed hitters, to what we call the honey hole. And he gave up a number of home runs, more than he should have. And all we did was show him how he might be able to utilize the four-seam fastball up in the zone, combine that with his slider and a very good curveball, and throw in the changeup, and he took off. And, you know, when you're dealing with the Verlanders and Coles of the world, the Charlie Mortons of the world, you're really dealing with high-level people, and the credit goes to them. They just don't want to be good. They want to be great, okay? And I think wanting to be great and turning every rock over that they can find to gain an edge, I think served them well. And I was just blessed. I was just blessed, and I have been blessed with the Astros to have the Dallas Keuchels and the Verlanders and the Coles and now with the young McCullers and now it's fun to have Zach Greinke.
Hey guys, Mike, mute your mics, please. Go ahead, Brent.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, and now I have now I get the honor of trying to understand Zach Greinke, which is a whole new ball game.
You know, we're going to take a question here. Some guys and gals, I'm going to paraphrase some questions sometimes, obviously, because some of them can be long, and I'll try my best at that. But here, a great example here, when you're talking about movements, the body in itself, for example, do you teach the lower half differently to a pitcher who has antiverted hips or retroverted hips, and also the different body types? Is that taught differently?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you should ask that. I just finished a webinar with Randy Sullivan where he talked about the hips. And I learned something from Randy, as I always do. And when you brought up the retroverted hips, obviously I was taking notes to that effect, because we had been teaching a certain position on the rubber that had been we'd utilized. And then I've talked to some other people about how the foot should be placed on the rubber in regards to how their hips are lined up. And so it's a continuous learning for me. Sometimes we can get locked into a one way, one fix for everything, when we need to take each individual in and of itself, do an assessment, which we do, and then try and find the best positioning for that pitcher to be successful.
Yeah, and I'm not going to take credit for that last question, folks. That came from a good friend. He's a minor league coordinator with one of the major league teams, Mr. Arnold. So the other question Tom O'Connell has, I have a question about movement. In the arms race book, he talks about vertical rather than horizontal movement. Would he still work that way with high school pitchers? Meaning you, would you work with high school pitchers who had a good rising fastball?
Well, it's funny when you talk, the rise is the right word, because let's say a guy has, if we look at a clock and we see a Kershaw fastball, basically, if you're looking at a clock, is 12 to 6, dead straight. Really stays on the vertical line. Not a lot of people throw like that. The ball doesn't, and you have other people that cut the ball a little bit. Mariano Rivera, the guy we had, Will Harris, the ball cuts. And then you have what we call rise and run. And there's some people, let's say the ball has a spin axis at 1 o'clock. That's a very advantageous pitch also. So I would not take a pitcher. I've tried to do this in the past and failed miserably, where I've tried to elicit the perfect 12 o'clock four-seam fastball, and we end up tilting the torso further than he should. We start doing some crazy stuff. So I've been as guilty as anybody trying to chase the perfect thing. I would take each pitcher's strength, and if he has a 130 spin axis as a right-handed pitcher, and then what we would do is trying to utilize that pitch as best we can. We call it a rise and run. It's something Charlie Morton had, which rather than trying to sink the ball, Charlie took his four-seam fastball, had rise and run, combined that with a plus-plus curveball, and the rest is history. He was third in the Cy Young Award last year and one of my favorite pitchers that I've ever had the pleasure of working with.
We're going to get to a question about grip 1 second here, but I just want to ask for some of our younger coaches working with younger players. When Brett Strom gets – let's say I bring my 14-year-old son to you, and you're going to work with him for a couple of weeks. Where do you start, you know, as far as analyzing him, and then – continuing to work with them? What are some of the advice for some of the coaches?
Well, the first thing I would do is I would keep my mouth shut as long as possible and let him just throw. It's one of the things I learned a long time ago from the pitching coaches is when to be quiet. I think when to shut up is one of the best pieces of advice I could give a pitching coach. You find yourself going out for a 10-minute bullpen session, let's say, and before you know it, it's a half hour later. And the guy hasn't got his work in. You stop him every two or three pitches. You try and correct things. One thing I learned from Randy just the other day is, and Franz Bosch talked about it, the body doesn't really doesn't associate itself with verbal cues. And I've been as guilty as anybody saying, hey, get your arm here, put your foot there. Rather, you need to devise possibly subvertive ways of getting him to move in a way that get you to where you want to get with that young man. So basically you'd look at his body movement, you'd look at how his rhythm, his tempo, his timing, you'd look at how he, Paul touched upon it, I thought very adequately in terms of loading the body correctly, hinging the body, and then rotating. And the biggest thing is if there's any pain, that's the number one thing you need to check. If he has soreness or pain, then we need to back off, find out where that pain is. And let's say we have a movement that we're not real happy with. A lot of times what I'll do is run the camera backwards and see where the previous movement happened and see if that previous movement could be adjusted, which would then possibly help the movement pattern that you may not be happy with. But constantly, number one thing, always listen to your players. Let them tell you how they feel, and you can move forward that. And remember one thing, coaches, trial and error. Trial and error. If you are wrong, if it doesn't work, then just find another way. There's no other way of really getting through the player. And don't be dogmatic. Don't feel as though just because your favorite pitcher did it a certain way. For example, my favorite pitcher I've mentioned already was Sandy Koufax. I would not teach people to throw like Sandy Koufax. As great as Sandy was, his career was shortened due to elbow issues. And so as we look at movement patterns, Sandy would not be somebody I would. Somebody like Maddox, somebody like the late Bob Feller, some other pitchers that I utilized, Roger Clemens, Nolan Ryan. You need to look at the people that had longevity, see what they did, model some of that with your pitcher, and I think you'll find some success.
You know, interesting. I love that you brought up the part about the camera and running it backwards. 25 years ago, I remember listening to Ron Wolford in Iowa talk about backward shaping and the Russian type of training. Is that where that comes from? And do you still use going backwards as part of a training process?
Yeah, no question. You know, it's if the player doesn't know where the release point is, then start from the release point and work backwards as to getting to that release point. It's just like in golf. If I were to teach my 102-year-old mother-in-law to hit a golf ball, the first thing I would do if she'd never hit a golf ball before is I would place the club in front of the ball and let her do her follow through. And then I would put the club 1 inch away from the ball, let her bump it and follow through. Then a foot away from the ball, hit it and follow through. And then 2 feet from the ball, hit it and follow through. If you don't know where contact is being made with that golf club to the golf ball, then how are you going to get there? Ron has always said, you know, if you don't know where you're going, all roads will get you there. So have a spot, try and get to that spot. And so backward shaping is a well-known teaching technique. We both learned that. Paul Nyman was really big on backward shaping and one of the greatest influences I ever had in my pitching coach career.
Yeah, and you've had a lot of them, and it's amazing how you consistently talk about them and praise them, and rightfully so. I'm going to take a question. Eric Peterson, you briefly mentioned that you believe the middle right finger and ring finger, are more important than the thumb while throwing a changeup. Can you explain that?
Curveball. Okay, I learned this from Sandy Koufax, and basically, if I don't know if you can see, I brought a baseball here. And basically, the way Sandy taught the curveball was to take the middle finger and place it along the seam and then get separation between his ring finger and his middle finger, which created a lot of pressure on that middle finger. The thumb, when Sandy pitched, had nothing to do with the baseball. That's because his hands were huge. So one of the ways that we can create this ideal spin is to create this separation between ring finger and middle finger, puts a lot of pressure on the middle finger, and then I just lightly put your thumb on the ball, and then basically you're just coming forward, creating overspin. And this is what I did with Garrett Cole, who had a tendency to manipulate his slider. His thumb was up, and he's right-handed. He had to grip somewhat like this. And all I did was take this and get it out of the way, put a little more pressure on that middle finger, and then he was able to just come through the baseball, created the proper spin. So a small little thing like that can pay dividends sometimes. And my suggestion is just to experiment, try. And this is a case where Sandy Koufax actually helped Garrett Cole with his slider.
Fantastic. Ido Pellet, and guys, I apologize, I botched that last question. He asks, as far as tunneling, how do you teach it? I mean, where do you start?
Well, where you start is you go to Perry Husband's website. That's where you start. He's the guy, you know, and I'm still learning. I don't know every facet of it. I will know he has helped me a great deal through the years. When I first got the job with the Astros, I relied upon him a great deal. And I think that I would suggest that just to kind of get a cursory feel for what Perry talks about, and then you can delve into it. There's different layers to it, okay? And even at the elementary level with it, you can benefit. And it's a great teaching tool for pitchers. One of the things it does for me is I used to sit there and wonder why somebody throwing 97, 98 miles an hour was getting whacked. And then the guy coming behind him was throwing 88 miles an hour and striking everybody out. This is when we thought velocity was the be all and end all and was the answer to everything. when you started to realize hitters don't hit the radar gun. What hitters hit is what they see or they don't see. And the more a pitcher can hide the ball, can make one pitch look like something else, can make a pitch look like a strike that becomes a ball, can make a pitch start out as a ball that becomes a strike, this is the way that the great pitchers apply their art.
Brent, you're always studying and then taking a look at new ways to do things. In the last 5 years, what have you changed in your coaching style or in your teachings that can help some of the coaches out there?
Well, I think I already alluded to one of them, and that was to keep my mouth shut at times and not just overload pitchers. I think my time with the Astros and even when I was with the Cardinals, the use of analytics has really helped me a great deal. I've talked about the technology. Instead of guessing as much as I used to, I think I still guess at times and I let my eyes tell me certain things, but then I go and verify it with what is available to us at the major league level. And this can be done at the minor league. This can be done with a youth coach. You can use your Android or your iPhone and place it up to the pitcher's where his release point is and see how the ball's spinning out of the hand. Is he pronating early? Is he hooking his wrist? Is he coming around the baseball? Is he not pulling down through the baseball and trying to create a hop to the baseball, different things. Let's take ball movement, for example. I learned a facet, a thing, and this is only to be not done in the game because, but a thing called misattribution. People were coming to me, how can I get ball movement on my fastball? And they were doing everything they could. And you know, pitchers have a tendency, Pete, of course I would never teach this and, that's I'm being facetious, but they scuff the baseball, for example. And when you scuff a baseball, the ball will always move to the opposite side of the scuff. And so what I would do with some pitchers to help them get the feel of pronation and let their eyes see the ball move is I would scuff a baseball very heavily, and then I would scuff a ball very lightly, and then I'd have no scuff on a baseball. And the pitcher would throw all three baseballs. And over time, his eyes and his nervous system would feel the ball coming off with the scuff and would move, and eventually – they started to get the feel of when I hold the ball correctly, this is the result that I hope to get. It's much like a golfer who has a controlled hook or a controlled slice and is able to put spin on a baseball inadvertently with a little bit of help.
You know, it sounds like every Dominican and Cuban player that I've been with in those countries, because every time they throw a baseball, it's never the same. It's a different weight, size, and they're constantly trying to make adjustments. Even with the mounds, they're making adjustments because there are no mounds. There's holes. You know, they're, now all of a sudden they get here and they can make those adjustments very easy.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They basically throw with weighted implements because that ball's been rolling around in the mud for a week and it's 6.5 ounces. The balls are scuffed up. They get movement. I think one of the things that the Dominican pitchers, for example, are very strong fastball throwers. When you look at the Venezuelans that we've had, their ability to spin the balls a little bit better. And then you go to the Cubans. That really have the full arsenal. You know, they can spin it. They know what they're doing. So you have different it's not to say that they can't get it, you know, the best way to be seen right now is pure velocity. And so the young pitchers in these countries seem to focus on that. But I always hit our international scouts and say, find me a young guy who has great command of a changeup. And I'll be glad to go to war with that guy because that can be an equalizer, very much so.
You know, it's interesting. We'll get to, hang on one second, Greg Byron. I'll get to a question here because I knew this was going to be an extremely popular show and there's a lot of questions. I really want to get to these guys' questions. Where do you see pitch types usage in the next 5 years? Where do you see it going?
Well, if the hitters make the adjustment that I think they're going to be, then we may go back to seeing more a little more horizontal movement, but until they make that time, I think the pitchers are going to continue, you know, with the evolution of the swing now, with the more lifted swing, the home runs, the lack of remorse, for another word, of strikeouts. I think that the pitchers are going to continue to what has made them successful until the hitters make the adjustment. I don't know. It would be interesting. It would be interesting to how a Tony Gwynn, a Wade Boggs, a Paul Molitor, some of the great hitters, contact hitters of our previous era, how they would attack hitters of today, pitchers of today. And that's something that we don't know. Pitchers throw harder than they ever have before. They're more difficult to hit. I read something where somebody said Babe Ruth would hit 170 right now if he was playing in today's era. I can't form an opinion on that because each era is onto itself. I would love to see Ted Williams hitting, my favorite hitter, to be hitting against today's pitchers, given the way he looked at things. I really can't say where it's going to go. I think keep riding your strength for as long as you can. I learned from Whitey Herzog a long time ago, and this always stuck with me. Hitters need to continually work on their weaknesses, while pitchers need to continually work on their strengths. Do not lose your strength. Don't be dabbling where you don't need to be dabbling. If you have a good fastball, hone that pitch. I saw Garrett Cole last year. He threw more fastballs in the heart of the plate, right down the middle with good hop, with great, great success, and he did not deviate off that. It would have been very easy for him, after possibly giving up a home run, to revert back to what he did before. He stayed the course, and now, unfortunately for us, he's a Yankee, and I wish him nothing but success.
As you talk about earlier about which hitter you'd like to see, probably the closest would have been Ichiro, who made major adjustments all the time. That's just the top of my head. But George Martin, he mentions Verlander in the 2019 World Series possibly getting a little fatigued. How do you work through all that?
Well, JV in the World Series ended up having, I think, even 5 innings, 100-plus pitches. I think what really took its toll was Washington. It was a very good fastball-hitting team. JV, of course, is a primarily fastball, slider, curveball pitcher. And they just battled him. A lot of foul balls, a lot of deep counts. He didn't pitch poorly. We didn't score in his game exceptionally well. And I think that had a lot to do with it. So credit to Washington being a very good fastball hitting team. They were a different approach for us than the Yankees were. And they just wore him down. And we ended up losing the ball game.
The next question comes from Tom O'Connell. No, he doesn't get preference because he's my boss with ISG Baseball. He just happens to be, in line here. I'm trying to get to the questions. There's a lot of them. DJ mentions that too much emphasis on teaching curveball grip. He recommends having pitchers start with their fastball grip and gradually working that grip until they get good movement with the curveball.
Okay, let's see if I understand what the question is. Different curveball. I basically did know the curveball grip that I've had success in utilizing with pitchers down the road. I firmly believe you need to get your four-seam fastball going first, and to understand the movement there. And a guy like Bert Blyleven threw his curveball. All he did, he threw four-seam fastball with his fingers on top of the ball, and then he went to the side of the baseball and threw the same pitch. There was really no grip change. So again, it's just trial and error. How the pitcher feels, the best way to get the spin that you're looking for, and always verify depending on what technology you have at your disposal.
All right, take another one. Do you foresee a resurgence of sinker slider lateral movement guys now that hitters are game planning to counter vertical pitchability, which I think you addressed a little also?
Well, until they show me they're gonna beat me, I'm gonna stay with what brought me to the dance. Okay, so I'm not. There are places for this pitch. For example, let me make a good point here. The hardest hit pitch in baseball is the sinker thrown by a right-handed hitter to a left-handed hitter. I mean, by a right-handed pitcher to a left-handed hitter. Think about this for 1 second. When I throw a sinker as a right-handed pitcher to a left-handed hitter, for it to be a strike, I have to start it down the middle of the plate. Therefore, the hitters are geared to swing. The pitch is moving away from the left-handed hitter. Is it going faster or slower to his brain? It is going slower. The hitter swings the bat, and where is it running? Where is the ball running to? It's running to the barrel of the bat, the danger spot for pitchers. And lastly, he makes contact with an extended front arm. That is a prescription for damage. Now let's reverse it and make a right-handed pitcher throwing the sinker in on a right-handed hitter. The opposite of plays now. The ball is picking up speed. It is running to the narrowest part of the bat. It is running to the part of the bat that is moving the slowest when the hitter swings. So all of that is good. So that is one of the reasons why the sinker to right-handed hitters or to opposite side hitters is not as good a pitch as most people believe. I was just on Twitter today, and I saw a piece, and I think all of it can go on it. I think it was Kluber, I think it was Trinan, and I think it was somebody else talking about two-seam fastballs thrown to left-handed hitters, and they came up with their game plan. I think it would be advantageous for people to look at that. And Kluber is one great pitcher. He's won a couple Cy Young Awards. But if you look at his numbers of two-seam fastballs against opposite side hitters, I think you'd be amazed at the success that hitters have had against him. This is not to disparage him by any means, because I would love to have him. But I think this is what people need to understand when they're looking at what the hitter's doing, his bat path, and what the pitches are doing. That's where you have to match it up and be ahead of the game.
Yeah, the Astros don't need any more pitching. They got enough. No. You got. Let's see here. Kevin Walsh talks about command versus stuff. He just wanted you to elaborate more on that, on your thoughts. As far as both. I mean, you use both more than others, or?
Well, believe it or not, I love stuff. Stuff plays. There's no question about it. In fact, there are certain hitters that we've identified that because of their nature of their swing, that four-seam fastballs can be thrown in certain parts of the zone that will make it very difficult for them to get the barrel to the ball. Now, if you throw it in another part of the zone because of their swing path, then the stuff, even though the radar gun might read the same, is not going to play as well. Because remember what I'd said before, and this goes back to what Perry talks about, a four-seam fastball down and away thrown 92 miles an hour is not 92 miles an hour, and the hitter will be able to get to it with a particular swing. That same 92 mile an hour fastball thrown in above the belt is not 92 miles an hour. It's now 96 miles an hour. So the radar gun will read the same, but it is two separate pitches to that batter. Now that's both command right there and stuff. So and the next thing, I don't know if many people broke more bats or got inside on right-handed hitters more than Jamie Moyer of the Seattle Mariners. And he topped out at 85 miles an hour max because he understood the ability to get in on hitters and create that illusion of more speed and hitters really not wanting the ball. They want to get extension, and you deny extension.
A question from Israel, Ido Paled. Hey, you're seeing guys like Otani and Lorenzen, two-way players. You think we're going to see more of those?
I don't know. I think they're obviously gifted athletes. I would love to have both. I've seen Otani obviously more than Lorenzen, being in the same division. What fascinates me is to watch him run. This guy can fly. Obviously a great pitcher, has great bat speed, tremendous athlete, and from what I've understood, just a tremendous person. He's going to get healthy this year. And so we'll see enough of Otani. And I'm just not sure there's that many out there that can do what both of them can do. Obviously, both gifted athletes.
Patrick asks, do you think, for example, Nolan Ryan would be as successful today as he was in his time due to the less stress he issued to his body with his pitching motion?
I think Nolan Ryan could have been great at any era. Okay, I think he's one of the great stories of all time. I mean, we're talking 26 years. It's still 60 feet, 6 inches. I can't believe that Mike Trout is that much better than Henry Aaron or Willie Mays, who was obviously just recently rated the greatest player of all time. So the hitters that Nolan faced, the one advantage Nolan had early was the higher mound, obviously, than what they have now. Greatness is greatness, regardless of the era. Bob Feller, any of them. I'm not one. I understand that the athletes are bigger, stronger, faster now. But these athletes of the foregone, I'm not going to dismiss what the great ones of previous eras were able to accomplish.
Brent, what would you like to see changed when it comes to the development of athletes or players, specifically pitchers, obviously? What's something that you'd like to see changed in the system?
Well, I would ask that all the coaches do as much research as they can. I know I was wrong on so many fronts years ago, and I have a list that I shared with you earlier, Pete, of influences and go-to people that I still go to all the time when I have a question. Some of them are big names. Some of them are well-known. Some of them are not well-known. And when I run into a jam, I don't try and pretend that I know the answers. I will go to people. And my ego is not such that I'm beyond asking for help. And I think the one advice I would give to people is to find your go-to people, the people that you trust, that you can run things by them, and run some questions by them and see if you get a different perspective. Even if that perspective is different than what your belief, and I've run sideways on some of these people, but just running sideways with some of them doesn't mean that I'm right and they're wrong. And so you can learn from each person. So I strongly suggest that each person listening today gets their list of go-to people and make sure you have their email and their telephone numbers and utilize them as best as you can.
You know, this plays off of Larry Sorensen, a question here, as far as scouts and also, you know, like in the system, you're the big league pitching coach, you've got the minor league coordinators and all that. How does it work? Who, you know, as far as discussing with the scouts, what type of pitchers the Astros are looking for to draft, to sign and so forth? How does that system work?
Well, you know, I can't, I'm not going to give you any trade secrets here, but, you know, they're...
Type of pitchers.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying, Pete. The thing is, when you look at the draft, there are performance players that we will look at that have great performance. Then there are pitchers maybe that did not perform, that obviously have a spin axis that we like, or have a pitch that we like, or a combination of pitches that we like that may not have performed exceptionally well in high school or college. So there are different things that you look for. There's a body type that we think may mature that we can help with doing certain things. So there's a variety of things that we look at. Let's take, for example, we find a submariner who leads the nation in creating ground balls. That's somebody we would not run away from, obviously, because he performed, and we would try and see how long that performance would play at what level. And then let's say he tops out at AA and he starts to not meet with the success that he'd had throughout his career, then we would look at pitch shapes, possibly add a rider or a running, a slider that maybe had an upshoot type of effect to it that could complement his heavy two seamer. So we're not adverse to looking at anybody and everybody. It's just that we try and identify the needs that we're looking for within our system.
You know, there's a big question comes up at every talk when anybody comes on pitching. Mark Fuller asked this as far as recovery. You know, every pitcher is different. Can you talk about how to recover a little quicker and some of the methods used to trying to recover your pitchers?
Well, you know, that is more on the training side of things. What we do is when a pitcher comes out of the game at the major league level, we obviously have 4 days off. And when I watch the veteran guys, for example, they have a distinct routine that they will go into the training room. Sometimes you'll see them riding a bike. You'll see them starting to still move and do some lightweight work, things like that. Most of them, this is one thing that I've come to appreciate about a guy like Justin Verlander, for example. No matter how he feels, if he's on a five-man rotation, and on the second day, let's say he pitches on a Saturday, on a Monday, regardless of how he feels, regardless, even if it's an off day, we will go in and he will throw his bullpen to try and get his body moving correctly so that he'll be ready for his start the following time. This guy is a beast, wants to get his 30 starts a year. He knows if he gets his 30 starts a year that he's going to get the numbers that he is looking for and to help this ball club. And just by his example, you see a lot of our young guys follow this example, and regardless if they're sore, they don't feel well, they need to go in, do what the trainer, and you'll see them on the massage table, you'll see them doing stretching, you'll see them do their weight work, you'll see them throwing their bullpen, you see the long toss, anything that will help them stay on the mound and take the ball. That's the number one thing. I think the starting pitcher, if he is one of these guys that you know you can count on him taking the baseball, that's all you can ask of the person. I think that would serve everybody's well. Now, if it's severe pain and things like that the pitcher, young pitcher is experiencing, then you need to assess that. And if it's such that it's out of the norm, then obviously you need to get professional assistance, seeing the doctor and things like that.
And I know we've got about 10 more minutes. This goes fast, guys and gals. We apologize, but this has been fantastic. Listen, Brent, as far as bullpens, are there anything unique that some guys do to prepare themselves better you know, to maybe make it more game-like or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a good question, Pete. When we have our bullpens, I always ask the pitcher prior to each bullpen what we are going to work on to see if what his idea of what he thinks we need to do based on his last outing or last couple outings, or what myself and my bullpen coach, Josh Miller, feel that he needs to work on. We will obviously review video from the previous game. We'll look and see what worked, what didn't work. And so each guy comes out with a plan. We give them an idea. We videotape the bullpen constantly. We have the TrackMan, we have the Rapsodo, and then we will work on certain things. For example, Zach Greinke comes to us, wants to work on his slider a little bit more. He'd been having trouble with it, and therefore we will expend a certain portion of that bullpen to the slider. Other people, Justin Verlander wants to work on his changeup. We'll apportion a certain part of that to his changeup. So it's not just coming with the idea of throwing just to throw. There's usually a purpose with this, and all the ones that I've been associated with that have been great, obviously have great preparation and great purpose in every throw they make.
I'm going to paraphrase for time, Greg Byron. Basically, I believe this is what he's asking. With the shift, you know, the type of pitches that you throw, the adjustments you have to make. Can you talk about how you guys do that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, that's another good question, Pete. You know, when the shift came aboard, one of the questions the pitchers asked me and asked us was, do they need to throw certain pitches that allow the shift to play? And the answer is definitive, no. The pitcher needs to continue to do what he does normally. The hitters, we have found, are very reticent or very resistant to changing their swing. They have been locked into a certain swing, a certain path. And I bring it back to a guy like Miguel Cabrera, one of the great hitters of our era. And when we put a shift on with Miguel and he changes his swing, let's say to block the ball and hit a 22 hopper into right field for a base hit, we say, thank you very much, Miguel. Okay. Cause a base hit, we can live with. When Miguel wants to do damage, which is what hurts us the most, then we will tip our hat to Miguel. He made that change and made it a change. Not everybody is Miguel Cabrera. So we tell our pitchers to stay, again, what Whitey Herzog said, pitchers stay with your strengths, hitters work on their weaknesses.
All right. You know, science changes, you know, technology gets better. I remember, and I can't remember exactly the year, but I remember working with Tom Howe, someone talking about, you know, you can't push off the rubber. Now there's science showing the opposite. What have you found throughout all your research and work?
Well, we're finding, you know, the back leg, the post leg is very, very important. It needs to be very stable. We need to understand that the post leg, you set up and then you basically, it's much like you're rotating off the rubber as opposed to a push. There is energy going into the ground. There's energy going back toward the mound. There's energy going forward. And I think Paul Davis, I think it was your May 5th mm-hmm. podcast, I think really touched upon that in detail. And I would suggest any of your listeners that want to get a feel for loading and then riding and rotating, revisit that May 5th podcast. I think you would be very enlightened.
Yeah, and I'd recommend three right away, Paul Davies, Perry Husband, and also Dr. Glenn Fleissig, all three. I thought we're outstanding shows. We got great reviews on that. You know, interestingly enough, the other area, you know, I had you on the podcast a year ago, I think it was, a year and a half. And I want people to know this because you brought up a couple drills. I know coaches like drills. And I thought this was interesting drills as far as a right-handed pitcher taking ground balls at third and a left-handed pitcher taking ground balls at shortstop, actually even playing shortstop. Can you get into that?
Yeah, I have a few drills that my go-to drills. One that I try and utilize the entire body as much as possible in these drills rather than isolating things. And for example, if I have a long arm left-handed pitcher for whatever reason was in Little League playing the outfield all the time, or at 12 years old, he became enamored with the pickoff throw. So he didn't develop loading correctly and things like that. I would put that left-hander at first base, hit him a ball to his backhand, let him drop step with his left foot so that his feet are in the position. He would bend over, pick the ball up. So he would be loading on his back leg. He would be, then his spine would be hinging. And then you'd come out of that hinge and rotate and throw the ball to third base. That is basically, as Paul put it, throwing begets pitching. And as the famous Paul Niman quote, the best way to ruin a pitcher is to make him a pitcher. So we need to teach these guys how to throw. For the right-handed pitcher, I put him at third base, hit a backhand to him, or put him at shortstop, hit a backhand to him. Even do a Jeter. Watch a ball hit to Jeter's backhand. That play that he's so famous for where he jumps in the air, rotates his torso, and throws a bullet to first base in Yankee Stadium. That's a great drill. So all of these, you know, there's the number of things you can do that utilize the entire body and utilize throwing as opposed to the pitching development. I used to – teaching a pitcher to point the toe down at the ground, lift your leg, point the glove at the target, stay back, keep your head on the target, be linear, not rotational, don't fall – all of these different things that I taught, push off the rubber, all of these different things. Boy, I hazard to think how many pitchers – that I didn't give my best effort to, and none of it was done out of not wanting them to do well. It was just ignorance on my part. And even to this day, Pete, and I say this sincerely, I don't know what I don't know. And so each day, I try and get better. And I showed you my list of guys. I go to them and keep learning.
You know, you mentioned go-to drills. I'd like to just stay on the drills, to end it off. When you talk about some are go-to, some drills, I'm sure, are drills that you use with certain pitchers that work, and then you try the same drill with another pitcher. That doesn't work. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. That goes back. You should have your toolbox of drills for whatever ails the pitcher, and be able to pull out of your toolbox those that have worked for you in the past and give it a try. It doesn't work. Go on to the next one. Ask him how he feels. I think one of the least misunderstood things that we do as pitching coaches is actually ask the pitcher, honestly, how does that feel? Where did you feel the energy come through? I think Randy Sullivan talked about this. Where did you feel the energy come through the body at this given point in time? Where did you feel good? What felt bad? Have a communication link with the pitcher that you're working with. And I think you'll benefit. Both of you will benefit from that.
All right, Brent, I'm going to let you finish it off. And I apologize, everybody. But I know we got so many questions. It's incredible. Great questions, too. Finish it off with, first of all, you had talked about, I can't remember where I saw it, but about cricket. You know, in the old days, they used to let you run and throw the ball. Now we're in a mound. Are we better off going to the run and throw? Are we going to save arms doing that?
Well, in my opinion, I think if you did a crow hop and throw, I think yes. I think the timing of that. And I think that's where on the mound, because they have the rubber and we're kind of stuck, the more you can develop a rhythm, the more you can develop a balance and a beat to the rhythm and dance a little bit. I think our Latino pitchers do that quite a bit. For example, you watch Pedro, he takes a step back, you see a tap, tap, tap of the post foot, and he develops a rhythm. I think that would be beneficial. I'm not sure if there are more injuries now than before. Something that I'll ask Dr. Fleischig about pre-1968 in terms of Tommy John to post-1968. It's something that I'll possibly share with you, and maybe you can add that in one of your future podcasts.
Yeah, we could put it on the show notes also. And as far as advice, to reduce injuries, what would be your major advice when you're working with pitchers to reduce the injury aspect? I know it's an unknown. But...
Well, each individual is unique. Listen to the players. Reducing injuries, obviously, movement patterns are key. Strength is key. Flexibility, stability. I would do my research. I'm going to put a list up right now, Pete. My list, my go-to list. I think people should pay attention to this list. I'm going to put it up.
Yeah, and if you want, you can, if you send it to me, I'll put it on the show notes.
Yeah,
also.
And this is my particular go-to list, and there's some people I for sake of not enough room on the paper, these are people I go to when I have questions that befuddle me a little bit, and so it's really difficult to say, start with the pain, though. If there is pain, back off, see where it is, see what you can do to minimize that, because we know one thing, I knew that better than anybody. Being the second Tommy John surgery, it cut my career short. It's not just workload, though, Pete. Workload is not the biggest issue. It's movement patterns that are the biggest issue. Poor movement patterns, good movement patterns. model the good pitchers that have had longevity. Paul Nyman talked about modeling a great deal. Find those pitchers that moved well, that were relatively pain-free, and see what they do and learn from them.
Brian, can't thank you enough. I know that, you know, everybody wants you, man. I mean, everybody wants you on their shows. Can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I want to thank also all, and on behalf of everybody on Zoom and on Facebook, thank you for being with us today. It was great.
My pleasure, Pete. Always good to see you. And you're doing a great job, a great service for a lot of these coaches out there by taking the time to put this together.
Thank you, Brent. And thanks, guys and gals on Zoom. I want to thank you so much in the U.S. and around the world for joining the show. Thanks on Facebook. We'll put the show notes up. Don't forget, I also want to thank, obviously, Brent Strom, our producer, Brian Kroc with the Lineup Media Group. This is a show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds that love the challenge, the status quo. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Check us out Wednesday, 1 p.m. Central. Matt Tallarico. Yes, he's another Italian. We seem to get Italians on this show a lot, but I guess, you know, that's when it's your show, you can pick your guys. He's a Yankees base running coach. He's got some great stuff. If you haven't followed Tallarico, check him out. We'll have all the show notes up and check him out on Wednesday, 1 p.m. Central. Join the show. Keep listening to the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds. Thank you all. God bless you. Stay safe, and we'll see you on the field soon.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.